With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we'll have this week's Almond Update. But our top story today, a new study shows California farm workers earned less after passage of the state's agriculture overtime law. Since California's new overtime law for farm employees went into effect in 2019, the state's farm workers worked a total of 15,000 to 45,000 fewer hours and earned a total of $6 million to $9 million less on their weekly paychecks than they would have without the law in place. California Farm Bureau says those are the findings of Alexandra Hill of the University of California, Berkeley's Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics. The study shows that on average, there's been a decrease in worker hours and wages. The overtime law, which is Assembly Bill 1066, was passed in 2016. The generally tranquil winter weather pattern the nation's been enjoying is about to come to an end. Gary Crawford has details.
So far this winter, the weather across the country has been unusually calm and mild.
But by the end of the week, it's going to turn very active.
USDA active meteorologist Brad Rippey says things are churning out there in the Pacific, and that's going to send a couple of big storms across the U.S. The first one will be crossing by the end of this week.
That initial storm system has the potential to bring some significant snow all the way from the southern Great Plains into the northern mid-Atlantic and everywhere in between.
And also could bring possible severe weather across Florida. Meanwhile, on the heels of that storm, another will follow.
It looks like it'll wrap up across the Midwest about a week from now. That has the potential to produce heavy snow and even possibly blizzard conditions in parts of the Midwest.
Rippey says, yes, those storms could disrupt travel.
But certainly from a moisture standpoint, these two storms will be beneficial.
Short-term pain, long-term gain for farmers. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We hear a lot about California's electric vehicle goals. Well, Canada is seeking to outdo it. They want 100% electric vehicles in Canada by 2035. Dennis Guy reports.
The Canadian federal government has instituted a graduated mandate for all new passenger cars and light-duty trucks sold in Canada to be electric-powered by the year 2035. Ottawa has several manufacturing incentive programs in place to motivate Canada's automotive sector and to make them available to consumers faster. The electric vehicle mandate was put in place to help Canada reach its emissions reductions targets, and over the past year, Ottawa has spent almost $270 million in manufacturers' incentive programs. Federal Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeau released the new rules on Tuesday that sets production and sales targets for Canadian car makers.
The electric vehicle availability standard that drives Canada towards all new light-duty vehicle sales in Canada to be electric or plug-in hybrid by 2035. The standard tackles one of the main barriers to people buying EVs, the limited availability and long wait time. The new electric vehicle availability standard now includes an early credit system to help automakers comply by encouraging them to get more EVs on the market.
The mandate is for 20% of new vehicle sales to be electric or plug-in hybrid by 2026, 60% by 2030, and 100% of all new vehicles by 2035. The rules apply to passenger vehicles, minivans, SUVs, and light-duty pickup trucks. Response to Ottawa's mandated phase-in of electric vehicles has been mixed, but a major criticism is Canada's lack of service stations outfitted with electric chargers. Terry O'Brien drives an electric car. O'Brien says he's glad he lives in Quebec because most of the other provinces just don't have the charging infrastructure that Quebec started to put in place a decade ago.
We're not ready for the transition because the charging infrastructure in certain provinces, Quebec's there, but in certain provinces like Ontario, it's not there. What needs to be done was what Quebec did starting 10 years ago.
About 85% of all existing electric vehicle charging stations are in Quebec, British Columbia, and Ontario. And with currently 25,000 charging stations in place, there will need to be about 450,000 stations in place to meet the new mandate's demand in 12 years. Brian Kingston, president of the Canadian Vehicle Manufacturers Association, agrees with that figure and says that Canada's charger station infrastructure will have to make a quantum leap forward. The move to electric vehicles is to be supported.
That means building 35,000 new chargers every single year. Currently, we build 6,000. We don't have the supports in place to allow all Canadians to switch to electric.
But Devin Arthur with the Electric Vehicles Association believes that with the Canadian government committed to the move to electric vehicles, the size of the charger network will increase in lockstep with the numbers of electric vehicles on Canadian roads and highways.
You'll have private industries investing more, governments investing to build out that infrastructure, so it'll kind of keep in pace with these vehicle adoptions.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's the AgNet NewsHour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now here's Will Durden with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, the new year gives an opportunity to look ahead at what's to come and reflect on the previous year. Though dairy prices in 2023 ended on a low note, Katie Burgess, Director of Risk Management for Ever.ag, talks about the 2024 outlook.
Our expectations for prices next year is kind of middle of the road. We expect it to be better than 2023, but it's kind of a tightrope. Globally, milk supply is starting to tighten up a little bit. So if supply is tighter, maybe that means higher prices. But we are still really concerned about global dairy demand. We see places like China buying a lot less, Southeast Asia, Japan is taking less product. And all of those are big customers of dairy generally and for us in the U.S.
Seeing success in 2024 will depend largely on higher demand for dairy products.
If demand doesn't pick up, it could be another year of soft prices. And I think the lesson of 2023 was that prices could fall even further than you expect based on what we saw this summer. We always encourage producers to consider dairy margin protection program via the FSA office or dairy revenue protection insurance, because you can never say for sure what the future holds. So having some downside protection is really important.
In other livestock news, we've talked the last 2 days about California's Proposition 12 compliance certification deadline on January 1st and how it will impact both farmers and consumers. David Geiger from WHO in Iowa shares more.
Inspections are already starting up around the country in anticipation of California's Proposition 12 law. While officially in effect July 1st, the law requiring animal living condition updates for products like pork to be sold in the state begins in 2024. Michael Formica, legal strategist with the National Pork Producers Council, says inspections are going on.
California has approved 14 or 15 different firms to do these audits, or you can invite California out. I have heard of a couple of producers who have asked for California to come out and inspect their farm.
The most recent USDA report says animal confinement legislation nets compliant pork an average $4.94 a hundredweight premium. When it comes to Prop 12 enforcement for that premium, Formica says there are some updates.
California has exempted ground meat because it's not a whole pork. It's not a whole cut of pork from Proposition 12. So ground product would not be covered. Sausage would not be covered.
In frozen food, NPPC negotiated to make sure any products in the supply chain sold before July 1st could still be sold. However,
January 1, that will no longer be allowed to be sold in California.
Formica does not think there will be any more delays. The law will be fully implemented. And one big concern across industries,
if you are a grocery store operator in California, if you're a consumer in California, you're already dealing with record food price inflation that has been going on. We have seen in California, price of pork is up significantly. Come January 1, I suspect that that jumps up some more.
Formica adds 60% of grocery sales in California are from small, independent-run grocers.
Those generally don't have access to compliant pork, and so we're watching that marketplace as well.
I'm David Geiger.
The beef checkoff works hard domestically and abroad. U.S. Meat Export Federation is fueling demand for U.S. beef internationally by strategically investing in promotional activities in key markets. John Harris from U.S. Meat Export Federation shares more.
Fueled by promotional activities funded by the Beef Checkoff Program, U.S. beef exports to Central America have gained momentum in recent months, including a record October volume to Costa Rica and very strong growth in Honduras. Lucia Ruano, U.S. Meat Export Federation representative in Central America, recently updated cattle producers and other industry leaders on these promotional activities, including the annual Barbecue Fest in Costa Rica.
This is the Barbecue Fest Costa Rica. There were more than 5,500 people that attended this event. This is an event that is supported by the Kansas City Barbecue Society, so it makes it international competition. And 24 teams participated in this competition among the professionals, amateurs, or just people passionate for barbecue. We had two spots in the main stage where we had chefs talking about all the great qualities, the benefits, and the attributes of the beef cuts that were promoted in this event.
In Honduras, USMEF combined billboard advertising with U.S. beef training workshops for key restaurant staff.
Along with promotion, we also tried to do some education, and this is the case of Honduras, where we had these billboard campaigns, bus stop billboards, that were near the stores of our commercial key partner, and we advertised U.S. beef cut through these billboards. The cuts were outside skirt, culotte, and strip loin. And simultaneously, we did workshops and we trained staff from 8 restaurants, and there was approximately 95 people that were trained during that period. This took place in the cities of San Pedro Sula and Tegucigalpa, and our importer reported 38% increase of sales during the period of this campaign.
For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harreth.
In other livestock news from the American Sheep Industry Association, now through July 2024, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service and Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service's National Animal Health Monitoring System are partnering to conduct a national study focusing on sheep and lamb health and management in the United States. This study, conducted approximately every 10 years, consists of two phases, including biological sampling and two questionnaires. Producers, industry stakeholders, and policymakers will benefit from the benchmark data produced by this survey. Survey results will provide a greater understanding of sheep health status throughout the United States and provide valuable insight into management practices and disease preparedness and identify educational needs and opportunities related to sheep health. NAS has made survey response more convenient and accessible through its online respondent portal at agcounts.usda.gov. On the website, producers can complete the NAS survey, view historical reports, and access other resources. NAS and NOMS are required by law to keep all information confidential, use the data for statistical purposes only, and publish in aggregate form to prevent disclosing the identity of any individual producer or farm operation. The results will be announced and published at the conclusion of the sheep study. For Agnet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture reports that food prices were expected to increase 5.8% in total for 2023. According to the Consumer Price Index, food prices are expected to continue to decelerate in 2024. This year, all food prices are predicted to increase 1.2%, with a prediction interval between -2% and 4.7%. Food at home prices are predicted to decrease 0.6%, with a prediction interval of -5.3% to 4.6%. And food away from home prices are predicted to increase 4.9%, with a prediction interval of 3.2% to 6.6%. Those figures represent a sharp departure from 2022, when food prices increased 9.9%, with grocery prices up 11.4% and restaurant prices up 7.7%. The U.S. dollar has been strengthening over the past few months, impacting ag exports. Senior analyst covering fruits and tree nuts for Rabo Agri Finance, David Magana, explained how exchange rates have been affecting demand for American ag products.
The dollar has been quite strong over the past few months. Just like 14 months ago, we saw probably a multi-year high in terms of the strength of the dollar against many key currencies, such as the Indian rupee, the Chinese yuan, the Japanese yen, and the euro as well. And then the first quarter in 2023, we saw the dollar weakening against most of the currencies, which favored exports of tree nuts in general. So we saw strong exports in at the beginning of 2023 calendar year. And then, but the dollar has continued to strengthen over the past few months.
The Department of Water Resources' first manual snow survey of the season is a fraction of last year's. DWR's Sean DeGuzman detailed how California's snowpack is measuring up to start the new year.
We recorded a snow depth of 7.5 inches and a snow water content of 3 inches. That results in 30% of average to date and 12% of the April 1 average here at this location. For our statewide snowpack based off of our automated snow sensor network, our statewide snowpack is looking at about 25% of average to date, which is pretty well in line with what we're seeing today here at Phillips. And on the state last year, our statewide snowpack was already at 177% of average to date. Today's result shows that it's really still too early to determine what kind of year we'll have in terms of wet or dry. I mean, there can be so many things that happen with our storm systems between now and April when we should see our peak snowpack.
The National Farmers Union's 122nd anniversary convention will be taking place in March in Arizona. The convention will feature policymakers and educators discussing a variety of topics ranging from fair and competitive markets to cooperatives, engaging the next generation, biofuels, and more. The event's going to be held March 10th through the 12th at the Scottsdale Plaza Resort in Scottsdale, Arizona. The convention provides an opportunity for networking with farmers union members from across the country and farmers union leadership. There will also be a debate and adoption of the NFU 2024 grassroots policy, and NFU President Rob LaRue will be delivering a State of the Farmers Union address. Registration for the event will remain open through February 28. More information about the 122nd Anniversary Convention will be made available at nfu.org/convention. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
What happens to that Christmas tree once the holidays are over? That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
This year, cities and towns will be doing the usual curbside pickup of millions of real Christmas trees, chopping them up for mulch. But Kansas State University forester Charlie Barden says in some places they are putting old Christmas trees to use underwater.
We just usually take a half a cinder block or so and a stout piece of rope to tie it onto the base of the tree and sink it into a pond. And it kind of acts like a mini coral reef. Different vegetation, algae, plants will grow around on the branches, and that'll attract young fish and small minnows like that, and the larger fish will come in to the shade and the shelter provided by the sunken tree.
Or some beach towns put old trees to good use.
We've seen some used for erosion on sand dunes. I'm actually from Rhode Island, from the East Coast, and they take some Christmas trees and anchor them in the sand to help the blowing sand stop erosion on the coast.
And those are just a few ways that old Christmas trees are being given new life. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. Are you looking for an entry-level job with good pay? Well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture may have just the job for you. Gary Crawford reports.
Does this describe you and your hunt for an entry-level job, a job that's more than just a paycheck? Is this you?
I really want to work on climate change. I don't know how to get my foot in the door.
If that's you, listen up. The door of opportunity is opening, slowly, loudly, but opening. Claire Silroski is with USDA's Rural Development Mission, working with that agency's energy program, some of which help farmers pay for installing clean energy systems such as wind and solar. She says applications from producers for those programs have been setting records.
We just have a lot of demand now for these new programs that address the climate challenge, also help farmers. And so we need more people to help us administer these programs.
So just before Christmas, USDA posted job announcements for 40 new positions under what it's calling the Climate Change Fellows Program. These new positions opening up initially in 33 states and Puerto Rico.
They're for people that don't have necessarily have a lot of experience in climate change. You don't have to be a climate change expert. Maybe it's an interest of yours. Maybe it's something that you care a lot about. Ideally, maybe you do have some kind of degree related to it, but you don't have to. And the idea of the fellows is to kind of get your foot into the door in this space and be able to work on something related to climate change, help solve that part of that crisis with us, and join us as a climate fellow. And there are 2-year positions that can be extended for 2 more years for a total of 4 years. And again, they're really for entry level folks that are interested in working on this issue, that are passionate maybe about climate change and want to do something about it. And we are able to, you know, put these new jobs out there.
But they won't be out there long. Yes, Claire says the job application deadline's very soon now, January 9th. For more information, go online, search Climate Fellows USDA, Climate Fellows USDA. Now, Claire, I guess it would be rude of me to ask how much, you know, these jobs pay to start. Come on, you can tell me.
You know, they're entry-level positions, but it's still a good salary.
Well, good. It's good enough for me. I'll take it. I'll take it. Again, for more information, go online, search Climate Fellows USDA. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The Farmers for Soil Health Initiative started with the soy, corn, and pork commodity groups looking to collaborate in the sustainable space. Chad Smith has more.
Jack Cornell, Director of Sustainable Supply for the United Soybean Board, says the initiative was aided by a substantial grant from USDA's Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities.
We were awarded one of the largest grants, which was $95 million. And how we are using that money is to do cost share for farmers putting on cover crops, around $70 million of it, with $20 million going towards technical assistance, like helping farmers actually navigate cover crops. And then within the remaining funds is really looking at building an infrastructure for an open market trading platform, essentially allowing farmers to go in and negotiate with box companies or different companies that want to offset some of their different environmental footprint things and allow farmers to actually openly negotiate for the selling of those beans virtually to those organizations that want to offset those.
The initiative set a goal of 30 million acres of cover crops by 2030. Cornell says that's just one of the sustainability objectives the program is looking to deliver for farmers.
We worked with those state commodity groups. They told us what they want the technical assistance to look like. They implemented it, and then we're putting the funding structure in for that. And so what they're doing is they're helping farmers with not only cover crops and this platform, but also anything else, whether it's thinking about no-till or reduced till, but really thinking about helping farmers along their sustainability journey. And so that's really our delivery system. But it's kind of unique because not only do you have national level commodity groups contributing and helping put this in the right position, we're also working together with our state commodity groups as a true partner in this and really having a lot of layers of farmer influence and farmer insights into making a top tier program.
Farmers for Soil Health is a farmer led initiative, and that's important.
So many times farmers are put in a position of price takers, not price makers. And this is an opportunity for farmers to go out there to showcase their operation and what they're doing, and then actually get a fair price for them making those risks and taking on adjusting their tillage programs, putting on cover crops, and actually getting paid for it and getting a fair payment for them making those decisions. And what we want to do is make sure that our program stays central to that core, but we also put in a farmer advisory panel who's going to also oversee our work and making sure that we're creating the most farmer-centric program that we can.
The initiative is looking for more applications from farmers who want to plant cover crops. Cornell also says the new trading platform is scheduled to go live in the spring. Keep up with the latest news from the United Soybean Board at unitedsoybean.org and Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on RFD TV. Chad Smith reporting.
Four tribal nations were the first recipients of a USDA grant program designed to strengthen food sovereignty and expand local and regional supply chains. Here's Rod Bain with more.
A first of its kind USDA grant program
is increasing food sovereignty and supply chain resiliency within tribal nations.
USDA Rural Development, with the help and expertise of the Agricultural Marketing Service, has created this program as a direct response to requests from tribal nations.
Rural Development, Rural Business Cooperative Service Administrator Karama Neal says four tribal nations are inaugural recipients of Indigenous Animals Harvesting and Meat Processing Grants.
These first awards total more than $4 million. There will be nearly $50 million in awards that will be made eventually.
The grants are part of a broader effort in relationship between the Agriculture Department and tribal nations.
USDA is reimagining how we support Indigenous agriculture in tribal communities. We're doing that by bringing Indigenous perspectives into agriculture, food, and nutrition. And as part of that effort, we have partnered with tribes and tribal-serving entities on multiple efforts to make food production and nutrition programs more accessible to tribal nations. So this Indigenous Animals Grant Program expands processing opportunities using modern and traditional harvesting methods of animals native to North America.
In terms of what the grants will mean for specific projects,
two are in Alaska. The Alatik Tribe of Old Harbor in Alaska will use a $1 million grant to buy and modernize an unused processing facility that will help the community address food shortages due to climate change. Members of the tribe live in a remote village accessible only by boat or small plane, and severe weather can delay food deliveries and outbear depleting fishing stocks. The funding will allow the tribe to increase the amount of local game and fish they can process using traditional methods. This includes meat from the Sitladek bison herd that the tribe manages.
In addition,
the Palawadani Nation in Southern Oregon and Northern California will use a $2.4 million grant to expand a food sovereignty program that provides the community a space and resources to learn traditional processing methods for local game and fish, including black-tailed deer, Roosevelt elk, and Chinook salmon. The grant will allow the tribe to pay for three staff positions, a mobile processing unit, and outfit a recently built 6,000 square foot food sovereignty building with new equipment.
The administrator points to the role of these projects in long-term creation of local tribal-owned businesses and jobs associated with such, as well as a source for processed meats to assist tribal families in need.
When you think about that longer-term aspect, those are the kinds of things that we're looking forward to seeing.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Ryan German is here with this week's Almond Update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. We're joined today by Associate Director of Agricultural Research at the Almond Board, Sebastian Saw. And now we're only about a month removed from the Almond Conference in Sacramento last month, but it looks like the Almond Board is already jumping right back into things here in the new year. There's an event coming up next week you're hosting on January 10th. And so what's that going to be about?
Yes. Actually, I would like to invite everybody to our free Nutrients Summit event, where we'll have an opportunity to learn from industry experts about almond nutrient management. Again, nutrient management is a very important topic for industry, especially during these challenging times, because fertilizers are one of our most significant input costs, and because the appropriate use of them is key to satisfy regulatory requirements as well as to optimize productivity. We will be meeting on January 10th at UC Merced Conference Center, and registrations are opens at 7:30 a.m. and the event ends at 1 p.m. after a free lunch. So we have CCA credits granted, so I really think this is a great opportunity to all of almond growers, CCAs, and PCAs out there to show up. Again, the event, it's on January 10th at UC Merced Conference Center.
And the agenda is available online, and so I thought we could kind of get into it with some of the specifics of what topics are going to be talked about here and some of the presenters as well.
Yeah. So I started planning this summit about 6 months ago, so quite a long time ago, so that I could make sure that the relevant topics could be covered by the most renowned experts in this area. So along those lines, we will cover soil preparation and nutrient amendments with Phoebe Gordon from UCANR, then Catherine Jarvis-Chin from UCANR as well, and Devin Clark from YARA will talk about nutrient management and potassium management, as well as different fertilizer sources. We'll then move to talk about foliar nutrients and biostimulants. That will be a talk given by distinguished UC Davis professor, Patrick Brown, who has worked more than three decades in this area, in a really interesting talk there. After that talk, I will moderate a panel discussion to talk about how nutrient management practices have evolved or adapted during challenging periods. I aligned the speakers there will be Zach Ellis from OFFI, Wes Asai, almond grower and independent consultant of the area, and Garrett Bowman from Bowman Orchards. And if that is not sufficient to convince you to come, I will also like to tell you that following the panel discussion, I have aligned Dr. Franklin Gowdy, former professor at Cal Poly, to talk about fertigation practices and how to ensure success. And during the free lunch, Franz Niederholzer, UCNR Farm Advisors too, will be talking about strategies for organic fertilization. So we will cover pretty much everything you can think from a grower's point of view in terms of nutrition. And we'll have opening remarks from UC Chancellor Munoz, UC Merced Chancellor Munoz, the Central Valley Water Board's Fresno's office, and the CDFA Fertilizer Research and Education Program. So a very full agenda, but with a lot of dedication and thinking behind it. So I hope you can make it.
Very good. And once again, this is going to be January 10th at UC Merced. And now, is this going to be an all-day event? I mean, it's a pretty robust program here. So what's the time frame for this?
So it's a half-a-day event. Registration opens at 7:30 a.m. So make sure to try to be there around that time, because the sessions go sharp at 8 a.m. And we plan to finish at 1 p.m. with a free lunch and, again, free registration as well.
And just lastly here, a lot of this material and a lot of the topics being discussed here were also highlighted at the Almond Conference, but I'd like to just kind of focus and hammer home the importance of these topics, especially right now when things are a bit challenging in the industry.
For sure. And yes, while we covered some of this at the conference, this is really an opportunity to dig into these topics in way more detail with more practical examples and share more of what we have learned together. So I invite everybody to register to almonds.com/summits if you have not done so yet.
Thank you, Brian. We will be right back. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. Winter and spring rains brought welcome drought relief in 2023, but caused California rice growers to get a late start planting, and that delay rippled throughout the harvest. Add relatively cool weather in late summer and early fall, and many rice producers say their grain moisture levels appeared stuck or were slow to drop to the desirable 18 to 20% harvest levels. During an average year, the season from planting to harvest spans about 145 to 150 days. In 2023, it was 152 days. California growers planted about 501,000 acres of rice in 2023, nearly double the amount during 2022's severe drought. Weather experts are expecting a stormy start this year.
This covers the time period from January 9th through the 15th. So the 8 to 14 day outlook indicates that we will see a break in this overall mild pattern for the country. A lot of that will be due to these stronger storms over the next several days, helping to pull down modestly colder air out of the northern reaches of North America. That said, we are expecting below normal temperatures in most areas from January 9th through the 15th. And not unexpectedly, with a stormier pattern setting up early in 2024, we expect near to above normal precipitation nationwide from January 9th through the 15th. The area expected to be the wettest will be along the Atlantic seaboard, extending westward into the Appalachians, as we see a series of storms affecting the U.S. through this 8 to 14 day period.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for farmers in some parts of the nation, that's good news.
We still have a serious drought situation across the South. We continue to see agricultural impacts across the South in terms of pasture health, winter wheat, cover crops, and also on surface water supplies. We've got very limited surface water in creeks and farm ponds, so any rain that falls in those areas will be beneficial. Further north, we continue to see some long-term drought across the Midwest. We would love to get some snow and or rain in the Midwest in advance of planting to help replenish the soil moisture profile, which remains quite dry, particularly in parts of the western Corn Belt.
The storms are expected over the next 2 weeks.
With a series of strong storm systems across the southern and into the eastern United States, that's a hallmark of El Niño's amped up southern or subtropical jet stream. And so, yes, I think you can put a lot of the blame on this stormy pattern as we start 2024 on the effects of El Nino and its effects on the subtropical jet stream. So that is a pretty classic setup when you have storms emerging from Southern California to the Southwest, moving along the Gulf Coast and then lifting northward. So probably a sign of what we're going to see in the early part of 2024, pretty active storm track in various parts of the United States, primarily in the South.
More water curtailments for some California farms. Even with another 8 weeks of winter in sight, state water officials are bracing for another dry year for the Scott and Shasta Rivers in Siskiyou County. At its December 19th meeting, the California State Water Resources Control Board unanimously readopted an emergency drought regulation that curtails water rights in the Scott and Shasta Rivers, affecting farmers and ranchers. The order limits surface water diversions and groundwater pumping. It also prioritizes minimum flow recommendations to protect threatened fish. 2024 will be an important year for America's farmers. As Michael Clements tells us, the American Farm Bureau Federation is focused on the passage of a new farm bill.
The American Farm Bureau Federation has a myriad of policy priorities for the new year. AFBF President Zippy Duvall says the top priority is getting a farm bill passed in 2024.
Well, it's critical that Congress pass a bipartisan farm bill early this year. We can't afford any further delays in getting an updated farm bill that would address our modern challenges facing our farmers and ranchers across America. Farm bill matters well beyond the farm. It addresses food security, sustainability, to nutrition programs. And all of these programs benefit the nation as a whole.
AFBF will host the American Farm Bureau Convention January 19th through 24th in Salt Lake City, where other 2024 priorities will be established.
The priorities will be determined by our voting delegates later this month at our annual convention in Salt Lake City. But we will continue to work with Congress to address the labor challenges facing our farmers. We have a labor shortage and unsustainable wage rate hikes that really are the biggest limiting factor to the growth of American agriculture. We also need to create new and expand the current trade agreements. And we have resolved to keep defending farms and ranches from the burdensome overreach of regulations from our federal government.
Duvall says there's still time to plan your trip to attend Farm Bureau's annual convention.
At this convention, it'll give them a great opportunity to hear from inspirational speakers, fellowship with other Farm Bureau members, and even become a new member of our organization. We have a great story to share about agriculture, and that story will be on full display at Salt Lake City.
To learn more and to register for the American Farm Bureau Convention, go to fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Meanwhile, the one-year farm bill extension won't bring many changes for producers, but it may create more work for Congressional Budget Office folks. Gary Crawford continues our coverage.
This time 1 year ago, many people, including Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, were confident Congress would craft and pass a new farm bill before the end of 2023, when the old bill was set to expire.
There's no reason why this can't be done.
But as the deadline approached, the tone changed.
We're not going to have a farm bill passed before December 31st.
Instead, lawmakers passed a one-year extension of the current farm bill now for farmers.
Another year extension doesn't rock the boat a lot.
Except for the cost of the extension and any changes that lawmakers make to it. According to USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer, there are questions about that.
Do changes they want to make depend upon the Congressional Budget Office's scoring of the bill? And do they have to rescore? And do falling commodity prices change the dynamics for the tweaks that the farm bill writers want to make?
All questions lawmakers will have to answer in the next few months. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.